In the early morning hours of April 15th, 1912, as Titanic sank slowly into a calm sea, chaos on its decks escalating by the moment, by the second, over in the small town of Caerphilly, South Wales, at a corn mill built in the 1600s, a corn mill called Gellygrows, a 25-year-old man, Artie Moore, was at his desk in a shed, hunkered over and listening. He was considered the oddball of the community, according to some, a tinkerer misunderstood in a long historical line of misunderstood tinkerers, in hopes of picking up the nascent signals of a nascent but powerful technology, Marconi wireless. It wasn't a new thing for him to pick up signals from far, far away. He'd done it before in his little shed. In those wee hours of April 15th, he heard a faint signal in Morse code, CQD, and then the Titanic's position. Now, many people think that CQD means come quickly, distress, but it didn't. CQ was just an all call to all ships. The D was added to mean distress. But radio wireless was in the most early stages of development, and the terms that we throw around now weren't regulated or didn't necessarily mean the same things back then. They also weren't familiar to everybody. And Moore would have been one of the only people in his small community to understand what any of this was. But he continues to receive these messages in those wee hours, the new SOS signal. Moore frantically writes down the messages. We have struck an iceberg, sinking. We are putting passengers off in small boats. Women and children in boats cannot last much longer. Come as quickly as possible. Engine room filling up to the boilers. And then finally, the last call from Titanic, 3,000 miles away from Artie Moore in his tiny shed. SOS, SOS, CQD, CQD, Titanic. Both distress calls, SOS, CQD, competing at the time in popularity, both of them now. We are sinking fast, the last message said. Passengers are being put into boats. Titanic. Artie Moore ran to his local police station to tell them, and nobody really believed him. And to be fair, there's not much that a police force in Wales could have done at this point. But pretty soon, people in the community would realize that Artie Moore was absolutely correct in what he had received, and he wasn't crazy at all. I'm LA Beatles, and this is Unsinkable, the Titanic podcast. This is from 3,000 miles away, Artie Moore and a wireless dream. As always, first and foremost, I want to extend a thank you to my newest Patreon members. I want to extend a huge Unsinkable thank you to Nicole without the H. Thank you. I like that. Thank you to Kim Creighton. Thank you to Alethea St. Joan. That's a beautiful name. And thank you to Ilaria. I say it every time. It's true every time. I could not do the podcast without you. Patreon literally fuels the show. It ensures that the show can go on. And it also helps me as I write my book and I work on that really important culmination of all of my Titanic research. Of course, the research is never done, but I am in writing mode right now. So it's a huge help. So thank you. And speaking of Patreon, there are, of course, perks. Most importantly, the bonus episodes that post once a month. That's the main perk over on Patreon. And there are 3 years of them now. But also for my upcoming live show, there's an added perk. A couple of them. If you are able to make it in person to my live show in Pigeon Forge on April 13th, then you will also be invited to an exclusive in-person Patreon happy hour. And the details on that will be posted soon. If you are not able to make it in person to the live show, which I understand many of you are across the pond. Many of you are scattered all over the United States. Some of you are in Australia. So I get it. But I will be live streaming the live show to Patreon only. I will post the live show as an episode probably sometime this summer. I'll sort of unlock it later. But if you'd like to see it in real time or be able to replay it, you know, within the day or the week, then make sure to join over on Patreon. Now, I will save all of my other updates and news items, housekeeping items for the end of the show, as I always promise I do to do. That phrase didn't come out right. I always promise to do that now. I feel like in episodes, you want to get straight to the content, and I respect that. I had originally planned on releasing my episode on the Syrian passengers this week. Full disclosure, the research just wasn't ready. I found a couple of new sources that I didn't know about sort of late in the game, and it didn't feel right to present that episode to you without properly going through those, and it's going to require some rewrites. So that episode is coming, and it's obviously a really, really important one, and it's all about third-class passengers. It's all about diversity and the different ethnic groups that were on Titanic that we don't hear about as often. So it's a crucial episode, and I want to make sure I do it right. So sometime within the next couple of weeks, we'll be there with that, but it just wasn't quite ready. So I wanted to bring you something that came across my desk, as they say. My friend Shirley, who some of you have met in the Patreon meetups and have gotten to know her in those as well. She is a dear friend of mine. We've been friends for, I think we did the math, 25 years. Maybe 26 years. And she will often send me articles and bits about Titanic that she finds. And she sent me this information about Artie Moore. And I had never heard of him. I have read quite a bit about Marconi Wireless. I'm going to recommend a whole book to you about it. And I obviously, over the last 3 to 4 years, have come across a lot of information about Titanic and the wireless operators. Did an episode on Harold Bride on here, but I had never heard of Artie Moore. And I just thought, let's dig into his life a little bit. This is a fun episode, and it really ties into a lot of different things, as you'll see. And so, you know, I call it Titanica, you know, this idea that studying Titanic is not just about who was physically on the ship, but it's about so much more than that. And I think this episode really shows that. And it was really exciting to dig into some new stuff. So let's jump into Artie Moore. He was born in 1887. That means he was 25 years old when he received Titanic's messages. So 1887, Queen Victoria is still on the throne when he's born. And he is growing up, like I mentioned, in a 17th, well, not in the mill, but like at a 17th century water mill. Now, if you follow me on Instagram, and I know many of you do, not most, a lot of people don't have social media, and good for you. if you follow me on Instagram, or if you've heard me mention in a couple of other episodes this season, I have recently and belatedly fallen in love with Outlander, and I can't believe I resisted it as long as I did, being a historian and someone who is just obsessed with historical fiction, immersive historical feelings, I guess is the best way to put it. I can't believe I waited this long. But there is this really fun and crucial scene that happens at a mill in season one of Outlander, and it's also in the book. And if you know what I'm talking about, you know it's a great scene for a lot of reasons. But I was thinking, wow, you know, this mill is built in the 1600s in Wales, and I'm talking about that while also talking about Titanic. It's wild. So he is growing up in this pretty rural place, and Queen Victoria is still on the throne. We don't think of a moment like that as a super modern era. But of course, in the late 1800s, we're on the edge of technological advancement. So many of the discussions we have about Titanic, right, are about the dawn of the ship representing the dawn of the modern era, the dawn of technological revolution, the loss of innocence of the world, right? There's that famous quote from Jack Thayer about the modern world being born. And he was one of the survivors, by the way, if you haven't heard that name before. The modern world sort of being born when Titanic sank. And I don't subscribe to that cut and dry of a historical narrative. You probably know that about me by now, but this is a conversation we have a lot about Titanic. Now, I will say, before we get into too much of a discussion of Moore or of Marconi Wireless, I really recommend that you do some reading on Marconi Wireless. There's an amazing book by Eric Larson called Thunderstruck. I love all of his work. And this one is, I think, a lesser appreciated book of Eric Larson's, but it weaves the story of Marconi and inventing the technology. Well, not straight up inventing it, but implementing the technology and revolutionizing wireless communication woven into this crazy chase of this notorious criminal in the very late 1800s. I won't ruin anything, but it's a fantastic book and it's all completely true. And of course, Eric Larson is just so good at writing historical nonfiction that reads like a novel. It's crazy to think that a little boy born in 1887 would then be, you know, clicking out the Morse code and or receiving messages wirelessly from 3,000 miles away out in the North Atlantic. The technology of that seems so at odds with being born in on the grounds of a 1600s mill. This means that we have, through Artie Moore's life, this confluence of themes and this very crucial moment of technological change and the story of Titanic. So I want to drop Artie Moore into history a little bit. The world's a crazy place. Let's drop ourselves into a little bit of soothing geography and a little bit of soothing UK history. A lot of violence back then. But to me, there's nothing, as a historian, there's nothing more soothing than just talking about the general history and flow of history in a place. So Caerphilly in Wales, the town had been the site of a lot of strategic warfare skirmishes over the years. In the year 75, a fort was built by the Romans during their conquest of Britain. There was an excavation in 1963 that showed that the fort had been occupied by Roman forces at that point until the middle of the second century. Then there is the Norman invasion of Wales in the late 11th century. And by the middle of the 12th century, the area was under the control of a Welsh chieftain. His name was Ifor Bach. I'm not pronouncing all of this right, but let's just pretend that I am and let's roll with it. His grandson was a Welsh lord of Siginhid, which is what this area was called. And then it fell to an English nobleman named Gilbert de Clare, the Red Earl, in 1266. There were many, many skirmishes that took place on this ground. De Clare began even though this area was very, very, very contested, he began the construction of Caerphilly Castle. And the castle began construction on April 11th, 1268. So from one April to many, many, many Aprils later is a way to conceptualize this. So the castle was the site then of much violence over the next few centuries, and is a very pure example of 13th century military architecture, and the largest castle in Wales, and also the second largest castle in Britain after Windsor. And of course, Wales, very important in the royal family, Prince of Wales, anybody? So the town grew up around the castle, but like many places in Europe around this time, dealt with lots of disease, lots of famine, lots of skirmishes. The town was burned down at one point. There was a slaughter, a siege, and it was rebuilt in the Middle Ages, but remained very small. There were repairs to the castle in the 1400s, 1500s. At one point in the mid-16th century, the second Earl of Pembroke used the castle as a manorial court. In the 1700s, the town grows into quite a bit of a market town. There is massive industrialization during the 19th century. Again, this is all very common sort of patterns and growth in Europe at the time, and the population started to grow a little bit. The railway station opened in 1871, and by the year 1899, on the cusp of the 20th century, there was a large railway works maintenance facility, and there was an increasing market for coal. So if we roll back in that kind of quick history of a place, if we land back in the 1600s, that is when Gelly Groh's mill was built. The mill was equipped with an overshot wheel with a cast iron frame and wooden buckets. When it was working, it had two pairs of rotating stones to grind corn and barley and wheat. It was built in 1625, like I mentioned, and was altered and changed over the years as things evolved in the area. Mining developed, like I mentioned. There was a huge market for coal, and farming declined, unfortunately, but businesses adapted. In 1874, the owners started supplying seeds and animal feed, so they extended what their offerings were. In the very early 1900s, Artie Moore and his brother installed a generator. Their family owned the mill at the time, installed a generator powered by the mill wheel to charge batteries for farmers in advance of the extension of electricity to the whole area. So this mill goes from 1625 and grindstones to supplying early electricity, very early electricity to an area like that. When he was a child, Artie unfortunately had a bad accident at the mill and he injured his leg and it had to be amputated. And he, by all accounts, used this very bravely as a way to, as an entree into becoming more fascinated with engineering and technology. He was a tinkerer. He built a device that allowed him to pedal his bicycle while wearing a wooden leg. For a child, can you imagine going through the loss of a leg and having the confidence, again, the bravery to turn that into invention? I mean, I don't know that I would even have the courage to do something like that. But basically, the watermill at Gelly Groh's was a tinkerer's dream for this child. He used a lathe driven by the water wheel to build a working steam engine at some point. This is why, according to reports, this is when he was still a child, he entered a competition in the Model Engineer magazine and won a book called Modern Views of Magnetism and Electricity. And in the lore of Artie Moore, that rhymes, this is the moment when he receives this book that he becomes enamored with electricity, wireless communication, magnetism. This could just be lore, though. I did, when I was poking around online through some articles, message boards, you know how all this is online, especially with Titanic, there were a couple of people who seemed to be wireless experts-ish who had done some research on him and said that they couldn't really find any proof that that would have been the book that he received. So I don't know. It could just be a little detail that's been plopped in at some point to make this story feel more alive. But to be fair, every single source that I read about him mentioned this book and that being the moment where he became interested. So he was known throughout his community as a little bit of a character, developing gadgets like the bicycle. He began putting up aerials, like antenna for radio around the building. He strung copper cable from the mill over the river nearby, slung it between trees, and he used all of his engineering skills that he developed through his childhood into early adulthood to store electricity in these batteries that I mentioned, using a generator that was hooked up to the mill's water well. So like I said, he would, all of this built up to him charging batteries for local businesses, for farmers. And can you imagine what it would have been like to be in Wales in 1900? Yes, on the cusp of modernity, but probably still a fairly old-fashioned place where you probably still went to the market and, you know, got your bread and your meat and your carrots, or maybe you grew most of that yourself. But to watch somebody creating sparks from a radio transmitter, I imagine people felt that their minds were blown at that time. So the threads of copper wire that he strung across the trees and across the shed that he built, this was tinkering that would eventually allow him to connect with the wider world and would, on April 15th, eventually bring Titanic's urgent, horrible, scary calls into his working shed. So let's set the Marconi wireless part of it into history a bit as well. Now, this is going to be the most cursory, rudimentary version of this, and I can recommend some reading in the show notes on Marconi wireless. But basically, Gielgo Marconi was an Irish-Italian pioneer, inventor, tinkerer, who had been the first to see the advantages and also the commercial possibilities, money-making possibilities of putting wireless telegraph equipment on ships. And this was a really big deal. This was, the best analogy would be, this is a very early form of the internet. And Marconi was absolutely a pioneer. And the reason that there was a Marconi wireless set on Titanic in 1912 is because he was very adamant about pushing this technology forward and putting the wireless technology on ships. But the discoveries that he made were based on discoveries from several people throughout the latter part of the 1800s. So December 1864, there's a man named James Clerk Maxwell, and he had a theory of electromagnetic radiation. He mentioned this in a lecture at the Royal Society in London. In 1887, Heinrich Hertz, who was in Germany, confirmed these theories. So this is building on, this is all building up towards Marconi. Oliver Lodge was actually the first to demonstrate in public a transmission and detection of this electromagnetic radiation. This was in London at the Royal Institution in 1894, but his equipment wasn't evolved. It didn't actually convey messages that could really be understood, which obviously is one of the most crucial parts about all of this. And so Marconi is growing up in the middle of all of this, reading, studying from these people. And he attends lectures. He's in the milieu of educating himself among these intellectuals. He becomes fascinated. He goes to lectures by Augusto Ricci in Italy in 1895. That was an important moment for him. He is an entrepreneur at heart. He's a tinkerer at heart, not much different than Artie Moore in that way. So he set out to develop a true working system of wireless transmission. He formed the Wireless Telegraph and Signal Company Limited. That was in 1897. And this would be the first real commercial growth of this technology, of this innovation. And again, if you want a really good description of how he tinkered to make this happen, who he was influenced by, how it ends up on ships like Titanic in 1912 with these operators like Harold Bride and John Phillips that are basically the internet nerds of their day. Please read Eric Larson's book. And again, I'll try to recommend some other books in the show notes as well. So he sold his early systems to ships, to lighthouses. The Larson book goes into all of this as well. The idea was that ships would obviously benefit from really quick communication the most, that they would be able to benefit from this type of communication for safety purposes. Duh. Now, you may be asking yourself, if you're like me, you may be asking yourself, and I did, and I still ask myself every minute when I'm talking about this, and I've, you know, asked my friend Shirley, and she's probably going to listen to this episode at some point and laugh. She and her husband know about all of this in such detailed form. I probably sound like a kindergartner to them talking about all of this, but you may be wondering, why, if it's wireless, that Artie Moore is hanging up Ariel's copper wires antenna? But why are there wires in wireless, right? So here is an explanation that I found online. The wires perform two different ways. So when they're connected with transmitting apparatus, they shake, they have electrical force, and it causes electromagnetic waves to detach and travel into space, looking for other things to attach to, other places to attach to. When they're connected to the receiving apparatus, they are listening essentially instead, and they collect vibrations that have been sent into the ether. And the really important part of this too is this is happening at like, I mean, that's why Eric Larson's book is called Thunderstruck, at a lightning speed, back and forth, back and forth. So never in the history of the world at this point, you know, has communication gone this quickly without underground cables, without lots and lots and lots and lots of cables. So it's all about the reception of vibrations. That is a very, very simple explanation. And if you are an engineer, if you are a technically inclined person, this may be an episode where you laugh and you say, oh, poor dear, poor LA Beatles. She tried her best. If so, keep it to yourself. No, I'm just kidding. No, just know that I know that that's not where I shine on technical explanations, but I am doing my best. I have my turn 40 this year. I don't think I'm going to spend the time to change that about myself because I excel at other things. So by 1912, many ships had this apparatus installed, and Titanic is one of them. And these are manned by Marconi employees. I've talked about this before with Bride and Phillips. They were not employees of the White Star Line. They were employees of the Marconi Company. They were privately employed. And these were a lot of young men that were sort of the internet nerds of their day. And it was, the communication was done by Morse code, as I mentioned. The equipment would, from basic understanding, transmit for about 300 miles in daylight. And after dark, and I do remember Shirley and David telling me about this, and their, I wish I had their explanation recorded. It would be better than mine. But after dark, the distance would double, triple, possibly quadruple because of the refraction of long wave radiation. So at night, could go way, way, way farther. And the other beautiful thing about it is the Wild West of it, that it wasn't like dialing one number. You weren't just dialing a specific ship like we would think of a telephone or something like that. The channels were open and still are to this day. It's why a lot of people love this technology and like to still use it. It's the infinite possibility of a channel being open to anybody in the world. So when Titanic's wireless operators are transmitting, it is obviously the dead of night, so you have those longer distances possible. And it may seem crazy that Artie Moore picks up this signal 3,000 miles away. But I believe it. There is not only a lot of evidence anecdotally or in local history in Wales where people, understandably so, love this story, but there are also many other reports of these signals being picked up at far distances, and I'll talk about another one of those in a few minutes. The other piece of evidence that we have is that Artie, when he goes to the police station and he reports what he heard, he mentions the SOS signal, which is very, very new at the time. And sure enough, the newspapers globally start to report that Titanic had used the SOS signal. So this is more validation for Artie then and more validation for Artie, I guess, just historically speaking. So another sort of infamous reporting of the Titanic signals happens at Cape Hatteras in North Carolina. So this story also brought me to my home state. Well, not, I guess it's the home I live in now. It's where I was born, but to my state. And also, if you are at all interested in the lost colony of Roanoke, which is a huge history interest of mine, many of you know that, you know that Cape Hatteras plays a huge role in that. It is quite literally sort of the cradle of early American settlement, of Native American and European contact. So in 1870, the United States Weather Bureau had been established. It's now called the Weather Service, and it was under the Secretary of the War Department, which is now known as the Department of Defense. But they built weather stations in what they deemed crucial locations. And one of them was Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. And there were two men working late into the night on April 15th, 1912, Richard Daly and Horace Gaskins, and they received the urgent telegram messages, actually 11:25 their time, Cape Hatteras time. They immediately forwarded the messages to their headquarters, which would have been the New York station. And there was a 21-year-old named David Sarnoff, who would become the president of RCA, the Radio Corporation of America. There's so much history here. But at the time, he was a 21-year-old wireless operator. So he receives it in New York City. And he actually, because he viewed Titanic as unsinkable, he had seen all of the news articles about it, as many people in the UK and the US and all over the world had, he didn't believe it. So he actually sent messages back sort of chastising Daly and Gaskins, saying this is a hoax, this is not possible, and that they were going to be in trouble for their silly ways and that they were, quote unquote, clogging up the lines. But we know, of course, that they absolutely were picking up something truthful. So that's just another example of these signals being picked up very far away. I liked that one because it happened in North Carolina and because of the Roanoke connection. But you can look it up. There were some in New Jersey. It was picked up all over the world. And there's a lot of little stories about that and the Titanic signals. Now, this is really, really cool to continue Artie's story. So Artie was eventually lauded, not only in his community, but Marconi himself caught wind of Artie's skill. Marconi came to meet him, and Marconi offered him a job with his wireless company. The war breaks out, World War I. Artie is also employed as a technician for the Royal Navy. He supervises equipment being fitted for these wireless technologies. And because of his work, ships are able to communicate thousands and thousands of miles with each other. He continues to work with the Marconi Company. He does research in developing the radio valve and more innovations in wireless technology. In 1922, he fitted the first fishing boat equipped with wireless equipment. In 1932, he patented something called the the Echometer or Ecometer. I think Echometer, because it's ECHO, and I know that's what it was. It's just, you know, words can be pronounced weirdly sometimes. And this was this is important. This was a very, very early form of sonar. And this is insane, but the research that Artie Moore does on early forms of sonar will eventually, in the 1980s, or culminate into technology in the 1980s that Robert Ballard will use to find Titanic on the ocean floor. So this man from Wales, who grew up in the shadow of a mill, pushes forward, uses early technology, puts homespun versions of it together, hears the Titanic distress call, then gets to meet his hero, Marconi, who hears of his work, then gets offered a job by Marconi, and gets to work in his desired field, his dream field, for decades and decades. And then along the way develops technology that will eventually allow oceanographers to find Titanic. Talk about a life. Why have we never heard more about this person? How is this not a movie? Nobody makes movies about the right things. And he did all of this with one leg. So there you go. He retired from working in 1947. He moved to Jamaica, interestingly. But after he was there for 6 months, he returned after a diagnosis of, I believe it was leukemia, and he passed away in Bristol, I believe. So there you go, Artie Moore. And people remember him. People write about him. People talk about him. He's memorialized, I think, quite properly in circles of those who understand the history of wireless, not in mainstream circles, like I said, but he is appreciated for what he did. There's this great photo, I'll put it on Instagram, of Artie outside his wireless shell. And I think it was taken in the fall of 1911, so right before everything with Titanic would have happened. So we have photos of him, which is amazing. There's an Artie Moore Amateur Radio Society that you can join. I saw the Facebook group for it. So he's definitely remembered and thought of fondly in the wireless community. I don't know. I just was inspired. Shirley sent me this article, and I've always meant to do an episode that deals with the wireless a little bit, but I've always been hesitant to talk about the technology. And so the story of Artie Moore allowed me to humanize the technology, to talk about it in a new way that's not just giving you the, you know, ABCs of Marconi's life, which eventually maybe I'll get to. I don't know. I tend to not do episodes on the obvious things or people on this show. But the story of Artie Moore allowed me to get at the history of Wales, which I love. I've been there. It's beautiful. Allowed me to get a little bit of the history of Marconi Wireless, of a mill, of sonar. And that's the beauty of Titanica. And I don't know, I was just inspired to put this episode together. Some episodes take me months. There's a couple of episodes that I've been developing for a year and they're still not ready. But this one came together in about 3 days. Sometimes it just happens when inspiration strikes. Artie Moore, we remember you. What an accomplishment. I hope you enjoyed this episode. It's a fun one. And the story of a life well-lived and lots of wonderful accomplishments. If you are a listener and you live in North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, Ohio, these are all places that are drivable to Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. And a lot of you have messaged me over the years and told me that the Titanic Museum in Pigeon Forge is on your bucket list of places to visit. So if it is, and you're drivable to Pigeon Forge, and you have a spare weekend, consider joining me on April 13th for Unsinkable's first ever open to the public live show. Thanks to the generosity of the Titanic Museum, it is free to attend. It does not cost any money. But you do have to register. Their space is very limited and there'll be a limited number of seats available at all. And this is one day, one time only. April 13th, a Saturday, the anniversary weekend of the sinking at 11 a.m. My guest will be Stephen Schwenkert, who, as you know, if you've listened to the podcast for the past few years, is the co-creator of the amazing documentary about the Chinese survivors called The Six. He also has a podcast called Titanic New Jersey. He is well-versed in Titanica. He has been traveling the world studying it and ships like it. He is a diver, an explorer. He's got a couple of new exciting projects he's been working on I think you'll be interested in. And he'll be making a fun, exciting announcement at the live show too. So join us as we talk about the diversity of passengers, as we talk about stories that are not as told in the Titanic community as they should be. And there will also be, like I mentioned, a Patreon exclusive meetup after the show too. And it just keeps getting better that afternoon. And you can also sign up for it on the same link you can sign up for the live show. There is a roundtable with Stephen Schwenkert and the authors of On a Sea of Glass, which is, as you know, a very well-respected book in the Titanic community. So Bill Wormstead, J. Kent Layton, and Tad Fitch will be along for the authors panel as well. We'll be taking questions, still kind of ironing out the details of that, but that's exciting as well. In the show notes, you will find a link. This link will go to a registration page via the Titanic Museum attraction in Pigeon Forge. You will add tickets to a cart, but they are $0. You have to go through the process of checking out, quote unquote, with the cart to sign up, but the tickets are free. But you do have to register and do one for everybody in your party. Make sure you have the right number of registration, you know, like 1, 2, 3 in the cart. And secure your spot. I heard from the museum just yesterday that spots are already filling up and they haven't even done a promo push yet. So make sure you register and shoot me an email at unsinkablepod@gmail.com or message me on Insta if you've registered, if you're planning to be there. I'm so excited to meet some of you. But please consider coming if it's drivable for you. It's also a great opportunity to go to the museum if you've never been. There'll be plenty of time that day to also visit the museum. And of course, there's the roundtable. The night before, there's the Knoxville premiere of Unsinkable, the film, which is about the aftermath of Titanic and the Senate inquiries. That's at the Regal in Knoxville. That's a separate event and you do have to buy tickets on Regal's website, but I will be there. I'll be running the Q&A. So it's just going to be a Titanic weekend all around. I will be very tired after it's over, but I'm so excited and I can't wait to meet some of you, like I said. So let me know or let me know if you have any questions. Link will be in the show notes and make sure to spread the word. In the meantime, I will be back soon with finally the episode on the Syrian passengers and a couple of more episodes in April. And yeah, I'm in book mode. I'm writing. I haven't updated the feed quite as much as in previous seasons, but really please know it's because I am working hard to write this book, to put it out into the world. I want you guys to have it. And writing is hard. Writing is really hard. So consider supporting the pod on Patreon, because at this point you're not only supporting the pod, but you're also supporting my writing process. And it means a lot. Of course, that link is always in the show notes. And if you want to help the show and you don't want to join Patreon and spend a cent on a podcast, which I get that, you can help by rating and reviewing in Apple or Spotify or telling somebody about the podcast. We're going on 3 years here. And I, you know, when I go on to my stats page for my hosting service and it tells me which countries are listening, we're all over the world and it blows my mind all the time. So thank you. Thanks for being here and I will talk to you soon. Bye guys.